welcome to episode number 11 of the Open Paddock Rallycast. That's right, it's the 11th time since we split off from doing general motorsports to doing just things about rally. In this week's episode, we explore the world down under with review of WRC's finale in Australia. We also have a special guest from the Australian event. Globetrotting rally co-driver Phil Hall joins us. Phil not only competed in Australia, but has also done events in the British Rally Championship, Drive DMAC Fiesta Trophy, the Canadian Rally Championship, as well as Rally America. Speaking of which, Rally America just released their 2017 schedule this week, which looks decidedly different, to say the least. This is Open Paddock, the Rallycast. Well, as I said, we have a special guest this evening. We have Phil Hall, rally co-driver, as I said earlier, globetrotting rally co-driver, who currently is in Canberra, Australia, and joins us over Skype. Phil, it is great to have you on the call. How are things down there in Australia, which is now early summer, I believe?
Allegedly summer. It's actually raining quite hard here at the moment, which reminds me quite a lot of home. But the last week or so has been absolutely scorching, so it's making up for it now.
Now, but rain, but like still 75 Fahrenheit, or actually chilly rain out there?
It's a little chilly right now. It's cooled right off, but hopefully the weather will get better tomorrow. It's been raining all day. Like I said, that's making me feel right at home.
Well, one thing that we want to do is, you know, this is the first time we've had you on the show, and I want to kick things off by you telling our listeners a little bit, who is Phil Hall, and how did you get started in rally?
I'm a professional rally co-driver that travels wherever I can, whenever I can, to compete in rallying. I've been competing for about 15 years now. I started out doing road rally, which is sort of like your speed distance time rallies, when I was 12 years old. And then via a medium length stint in the British Royal Air Force, I then became a professional co-driver about 2.5 years ago.
Wow, that's impressive. Started at the age of 12. That, Ian, that means you have started way too late.
Yeah, seriously, way too late. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't start. Well, I started in road rallies, but I didn't start that until like about 5 years ago. So, yeah, I've missed out big time, I think.
So, Phil, how is it that you got the rally bug?
Well, I'm quite fortunate. I'm a third generation rally competitor. So my granddad was a rally driver, and my dad's a rally driver, and I very briefly was a rally driver, although mostly my career has been co-driving. So I think my entire family have been fairly well resigned to the fact I was going to get involved in rally. it was just a matter of time. So I actually started pestering my dad when I was about 8 years old to get involved. I started navigating the service truck for his rally team around using maps and all the other information the organizers gave you. So as soon as the minimum age you can compete on road rallies or speed distance time rallies in the UK is 12. So pretty much as my 12th birthday rolled over, I was in a rally car.
Wow. So even though you're only 28 years old, you have a ton of experience. And now being a professional, rally co-driver, you also have a relationship with the MSA Academy. Can you explain what that's about?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to be a member of the MSA Academy. The MSA is the Motorsport Association of the United Kingdom, which is our governing body or sanctioning body. And they run a talent development pathway which covers all motorsport disciplines called the MSA Academy, designed to push young talent and develop the future of motorsport. And they've set up a co-driving program to try and really push British co-drivers globally and take on those co-drivers competing inside and outside the UK that are British to new levels. It's largely being run by two co-drivers, Nicky Grist, who I'm sure you may have heard of,
Paul
Spooner. Oh, yeah.
and a very experienced co-driver called Paul Spooner, who's competed all over the UK and Europe as well. And between them, they manage this program, which takes a number of seminars throughout the year, usually over a weekend or a day or two in the week. We do all sorts of things like sports training down at the Porsche Human Fitness Training down at the Porsche Human Performance Center at Silverstone, where we learn about fitness and nutrition and how specifically for co-drivers we should condition ourselves for the demands of the environment we're going to be competing in. For example, it was pretty hot here in Australia, and we take advice on those kind of things, but also the best way to prepare for events, really taking all of that experience that those two co-drivers have and using it. And like I say, there's five or six seminars they run throughout the year, but also as part of that, we get one-to-one mentoring with each of them. Each of the co-drivers, I've been talking to Nicky a lot about competing in the WRC this year, taking his experience and advice on how to approach each event. And then when I'm competing in the UK, I speak to Paul about the different events we're doing there as well. So there's a lot of backup for the young co-drivers. This is my second year now. In the first year, there were 10 of us. And then in the second year, they brought a new cohort of co-drivers into the first year. And now I'm one of two co-drivers in their second year on the academy.
Wow, that's an impressive system they have there to keep, you know, I guess to create such a professional level for co-drivers and keep the new blood rolling through it to, you know, a ladder, I guess, system to allow people to start at the junior level and start moving up. That's really neat. Something we're severely lacking here, I think, here in the States, just as far as skilled co-drivers. It's just it's a hard thing to find. Ones that especially have that kind of a background. Now, you said that, you know, you had done some events in the WRC. We know that you were down there in Australia for that event. So what? Give us a rundown of some of the significant events you've done around the world.
Well, I think some of the most significant events I've done have obviously been the WRC events. But before I started doing a lot of World Rally Championship events, I was fortunate enough to compete in more of the national series around the world. I've done events in Finland and Japan and over in America and Canada as well, as well as the British Championship and other national series in the UK. So significant events for me are ones that are important milestones. Like my first ever podium at an international level was in the Arctic Lapland Rally in Finland. And then obviously my first events in each continent. So Japan and then Rally Australia last year. And my first event in Europe, which is also in Finland as well. So highlight events don't necessarily mean WRC events. It's events that are significant to me.
Right, right. Go ahead, Matt.
I'm just wondering how you get involved with national series all around the world like that. With MSA Academy, do they have some kind of placement, or are you going around specifically looking to go to those places? How's that work?
I was fortunate enough to do the events in Japan and Finland through when I was working with Toyota over the winter. And I got into that through the MSA Academy. They were looking for a British co-driver to co-drive for a Japanese driver, Hiroki Arai. And the connection was made that I was the guy for that job. Regarding competing in America and Canada, I decided I wanted to compete in America. I really, really wanted to. So, the only way you can do that kind of thing is through networking and speaking to people who are already there and kind of making a plan. So I got in touch with David Higgins about competing in America in January of 2014 or somewhere around then, a while ago, just saying, hey, I'd really like to compete in America. Do you know of anyone looking for a co-driver? At the time, he came back and said, sorry, Phil, not at the moment, I don't really know of anyone. And I got on with my British Championship stuff. And then 6 months later, almost to the day, I got another message off him saying, hey, are you still set for going to America? Because if you get on a plane next week, you need to chat to a guy called Chris Duplessis.
Chris, we love Chris.
who's looking for someone. So I was like, yeah, I might be able to go next week. I'll drop Chris a message. And about 48 hours later, after contacting Chris, I was on a plane to Boston. So that's how it works sometimes. Sometimes you just have to be flexible and speak to people in the different championships when you decide you want to branch out a bit.
Well, that's brilliant. Chris is a good friend of the show. I've been following him for a long, long time. And although his rally success hasn't turned into, much as far as his career accelerating there, he's now a professional driver instructor out at, what's the name of the place, Matt, out there in New York?
It's the Monticello Motor Club. He's one of their in-house instructors.
That's right. So he still gets to do driving fast cars for a living, so there's nothing wrong with that, right? we talked about some of the different rallies you've done that you said were significant. So I'm going to ask you some a little more specifics about that. Most memorable event so far?
My most memorable event so far has to be Arctic Lapland Rally because, as I say, not only it was my first international podium, but also it's a brutal rally, minus 35 for most of the event. And we achieved such a lot there, being a foreign crew. Usually it's a Finn. Usually the top five are locked out by Finns. So the fact we got a third overall was incredible. Such a beautiful rally. And just to be up there in the Arctic Circle was an incredible experience.
What kind of car were you in?
We were in a Subaru Impreza R4. Which was being run by Tommy Mackinnon Racing. Really, really nice car. We were quite happy to be beating our five cars and actually finishing in front of a couple of WRC cars as well, older WRC cars. So we were very happy with that result.
That's definitely impressive. Going along the same lines of, obviously that being most memorable, what was your most exhilarating moment that you've had so far?
One of my favorite moments was actually from a very long time ago when I did my first British Championship event when I was 16 years old, because it was a huge step up for me and we actually finished really well in class. We got second in the British Championship class there, but we were competing in quite a small cc 1.4 litre car and we were just flat out over the tops of the Rally Isle of Man in the pouring rain. And I just remember thinking, this is exactly what I want to do. And I've never been so, even at that age, I'd never been so fast in my life. And I just remember it being really, really exhilarating experience at that time.
Well, yeah, I can understand. Definitely it's those speeds that can take your breath away a little bit. What's been your scariest moment so far?
Scariest moment is a bit difficult because I don't really get scared in the car as such. I mean, I don't think I've ever been scared in a rally car, whatever's been happening. However, because you just can't, as a co-driver, your job is to be cool, calm, and collected at all times. And so I think the scariest experience I've had was actually I had a really bad crash in Spain this year, WRC Spain this year. And even though the crash itself wasn't particularly bad, we had a really big stop and I ended up going to hospital. And I remember just being lying in the hospital bed a couple of hours after getting admitted, and I was thinking, I hope I'm okay, because I've had MRI scans and things. It turns out I am absolutely fine, but that was quite a scary moment, just when you're thinking, I don't know if I'm okay or not, because of the consequences of the accident.
Yeah, that's well, definitely scary. Wow.
Well, we're glad to hear that you're okay, but I guess I can assume that ranks as one of your least favorite stages out of all the events you've done.
Actually, I really enjoyed that stage. I'd only done it once. Fantastic stage. We just got it wrong. I mean, it was just one rallying accident. We just got it wrong, and we ended up going off a cliff at about 60, 70 miles an hour, 10 meter cliff, so we ended up coming down through the tree canopy, and I just remember thinking, oh dear, we're coming into land quite hard here. But no, I actually really enjoyed that stage. In the Spain stages are fantastic, but no, it's not my worst stage ever.
So do you have a favorite stage that you've ever, overall, what's your favorite stage you've ever been on?
I think actually one of my favorite stages, it's hard to tell because there's so many different stages with all the different diversity of surfaces and types, but
One of my all-time favorites has to be Nan Booker at WRC Australia. It's just a phenomenal stage, and it throws so many different things to you. It's 50 kilometers long, nearly 51, and it's got little bits of tarmac. It's got some wide bits where you can really move the car around. There's some really narrow bits where you're literally just picking your line between the jungle. So I really, really enjoy that stage.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you something about related to the Nan Booker thing. You say like Nan Booker is like 50k long, and that's like 36 miles. You know, I've only been co-driving a year, you know, and the longest stage that I've co-driven on is like 15 miles, and it's the concentration that you have to keep up to even for that 15 miles was something I've never experienced before. It's like, how do you manage to concentrate at that level for 36 miles?
Well, to be honest, most WRC events have at least one big mileage stage. Each event will have something between 40 and 50 kilometers long in it. And the best way to prepare is to be fit. I spend a lot of time in the gym. I work with personal trainers and experts to make sure that my fitness is where it needs to be, because you're going through a lot of different G-forces and a lot of different sort of stresses in the car. In Nan Booker, it was getting at least 60 degrees Celsius centigrade in the car. Sorry, don't know what to convert that into Fahrenheit, but very hot. Yeah. And very humid and dusty. So you have to prepare for that. So I'm in the gym every single day, training. And if we speak talking about technical things, I write little notes to myself in the pace notes, just reference points, so I know where I am exactly in the stage within reference to other things, so like landmarks and stuff. And I write notes to myself about how I should be reading the pace notes. So, you know, concentrate really hard on this bit because it's actually quite tricky, or this bit's fast and flowing, so get the rhythm going now and hang on to it for the next 10K or whatever. And those little things, even if they don't seem massively relevant, they just tweak your mind being back in. You don't actually read them to the driver. I write them above in like an italic text, and that means it's just for you, Phil. It's just to tell you it's going to be fine. You know, that's what you need to do. This is what you need to do right now.
Well, let's now talk WRC Australia. So you were there co-driving for Reese Pinter, is that right?
Yeah, co-driving for Reese Pinter, who I've done a little bit in the UK with as well this year, in 1.6 Fiesta R2.
So how was the event for you guys down there?
Extremely challenging. We had some electrical problems after shakedown. We did a test on Monday and the car was near as perfect as it could be. We set some really good times compared to last year's test. We were very happy with it. And then we went to shakedown. We had a good recce as well, really good recce. The notes were great. And then we went to shakedown and something's tweaked in shakedown. We don't know what it is, but it's somewhere in the electric. Something's cried no. So on the way back from shakedown, the car actually broke down and stopped. I was driving, funnily enough, because sometimes I drive on the transport. Sometimes I drive on the transport, give the drivers a break. And particularly when it's as hot as it is. And unfortunately, it died on me. So naturally, I got the blame.
But, always the co-driver's fault, every time.
Absolutely. But we're still investigating what it fully is. It seems like it's a series of problems. But anyway, that meant that we were unable to start on Friday. We managed to get through the first control, but we got maybe a mile down the road and it died again. So we got recovered and had to sit Friday out. But we worked all of the Thursday night and all of Friday night to solve the problem, and we managed to get it back. So it was performing somewhere near where it should be performing. The only major problem we had was we'd lost the power steering completely. Now, staring down the barrel of 50k of Nan Booker and then 14k of the next stage, which was Valla, was a pretty daunting task in the conditions that we were having with the heat and the dust.
Is that electric power steering in
yeah,
that car?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's electrically actuated, I believe. It was an electrical gremlin that was causing problems with with the power steering. The actual power steering system, we believe it was okay. It was something within the control system, as far as we know.
Wow.
There are lots of other little things that were going wrong. We think it's a more centralized problem with the electronics on the car at the moment after shakedown. So anyway, we got out there and we got into the stages, but it was pretty brutal with no power steering for 50K. Poor Reese, he's a really fit guy. I mean, really, really fit guy. And I was just pouring water down him, trying to keep him going. And we had to really talk our way through the stages. Halfway through Nambuka, we lost the intercom. Like I say, the electronics things were just not working right. We lost the intercom. And so we were down to hand signals for 30 kilometers.
Whoa.
So it was pretty brutal. It was a very demanding event. But it gave us a really good opportunity to show how determined we were to succeed and show everyone that we've got some serious sticking power. We got to the end of that loop and Reese had worked so hard that unfortunately he actually passed out in the service in control. I was just about to book us in and he went down. So he got taken to the medical center and the medics said basically you can't continue. So that was unfortunately our Rally Australia over at the midway point. But we learned a lot. We had a really good event in 2015. We won the class and we got a top 20 position. So we were happy with our result from 2015. So we had hope to come back here and do that again. And our stage times were showing that when we were actually running, we were pretty good. So we're happy to take that away. It's just unfortunate. Sometimes these events don't go the way you want them to.
I mean, let me get this straight. So you had all these electrical gremlins. You know the power steering's not working. It's, 35°C outside. You decide to go anyway. It's so hot. And, of course, you're wearing your fire suits, which makes you 10 times hotter. As you're going down the stage, you're actually pouring water on him to try and cool him down.
No, I wasn't pouring water afterwards. I was pouring water on him after the stage and giving him water after the stage. But in the stage, it was plus 60°C in the car. We're pretty certain of that. And it was the dust was coming. It's incredibly dusty in Australia. Dusty. It's all coming in through the air vents. My race suit is just brown now. It should be black, but it's brown. And it's all in the pace notes and everything. Very, very dusty event.
I feel like you need a new cabin air filter.
But we certainly will need one, I think.
I'm just trying to figure out how hand signals work in a rally car, because I'm picturing my driving instructor at my first track day just sticking his left hand in my face, just pointing me in the right direction. Is that how you ended up doing that?
It's not ideal. You have to kind of do it on the fly, really. But once there's a point where the intercom became intermittent and I realized that there's no way I can trust he's actually getting what I'm saying, which is really bad when you're pushing, because we were still pushing really hard in the Fiesta. So it was a decision that, right, I'm going to read the pace notes and do the hand signals. So multitasking a bit. The way I do it, there's many different ways. I'm sure every different co-driver has a different way of doing it. And some co-drivers probably never have to do it, which is why you have to do it on the fly a bit. But I just hold up the number of fingers for the number of the corner. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. On the hand closer to the driver, and then point with the with my hand which way the corner goes. And usually that's a good enough indication to them which way it is. And then I make like a pull back motion for brake or stop, and like a pointing forwards out the windscreen if it's flat out. And you can kind of work it out from that.
Yeah, it sounds similar to what I did, because I was at Ojibwe here in Minnesota in the summer, and I did 2 days without intercoms. So yeah, I the way I did it was I left 4s, 5s, and 6s to my driver, because I was fairly confident in him. Anything that was a 3 and sharper, or there was a hidden crest, then that's what I would point out, because we tried indicating every corner, and he found that was too much information for him to take on. So
yeah.
No, similar system. Similar system.
That's beyond impressive as far as you guys made it. But I can definitely understand heat exhaustion being the way it turned out. Even Wojt Tanak was saying that he was getting a little bit of that on the stages out there, too. Australia definitely is a unique event. Matt, you wanted to ask something?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering, Australia has a bit of a reputation for essentially wanting to kill you. I'm sure you got your share of that, losing comms and dealing with all that. But Colin Clark kept talking about how prolific the snake population is there. Can you confirm or deny that?
Well, I don't know how many snakes Colin saw, but I have yet to see a snake in Australia. So, but that being said, I spend a lot of my time in a car. So, and he's outside a lot more than I am when he's out doing interviews and all of that. So it's more likely he will have seen snakes than I will. But yeah, I have yet to see a snake in Australia. So I can't really confirm or deny, I'm afraid.
Before I wrap it up here, Ian, you had a couple other questions, maybe?
Yeah, because I was just wondering, when people find out I'm a co-driver, they think, oh, that's really cool. You know, it's like belting through forests or whatever you're doing, high speeds and calling the turns and what have you. But there's a lot more to it than that, and they don't realize that. And when I tell them everything that they have to do, they're a bit surprised. And what do you think the attributes are that make a good co-driver? Because it isn't just the concentrating on the notes and reading those. I mean, what else do you think there is that makes a good co-driver?
I think I'll go to my mentor Nicky Grist on this one, because every single rally, everything is hammered into us and me, attention to detail. That's the thing that you have to take through as a co-driver, I think. And that carries everything from your event preparation beforehand to when you're calling the notes. You have to call the notes in the moment now, because that's exactly when it should be called. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in your event preparation, you need to pay attention to all of the different things you should have done and cover every eventuality. So I think attention to detail is super critical for a co-driver. There's all the other things, you know, the ability to manage a team and the ability to multitask, get people a lot of plates spinning a lot of the time. But I think one of the most important things as a co-driver is to be able to inspire confidence from your driver, mm-hmm. be that
yeah.
for the event. So when, because if you can build that confidence from a driver in you, even if it's a one-off ride, like I do a fair few events where I go and fill a gap, or I'll go and help a friend out, or I'll there's just one opportunity to go and do an event in that country. And you have to be able to get into a car with someone you've probably never met before the weekend before, and them go, mm-hmm. right, this guy's got his stuff together. He knows what he's doing, because they want to go flat out. They want to win these rallies, and, yeah. and they need to trust you from the get-go. And mm-hmm. that doesn't just mean them trusting what pace notes you're calling. That means that them trusting that you've done the maths right on the fuel and that you know where you're going on the transits and you're not going to mess the timing up. So you have to be able to inspire confidence, because you can be a very good co-driver, but if no one believes you because you don't act like it, or you don't show that to everyone, and I don't mean showing off, I don't mean broadcasting it, I mean have that personality that people just go, yeah, he's got it all sorted, he's fine. You're really going to struggle, because the driver just won't commit to you.
Yeah. I'm scribbling some notes here. I'm going to take this forward into next year.
There we go. Coaching with Phil Hall. Well, Phil, 2016 is all but wrapped up. And you've had great success in doing WRC events, like we talked about in our intro, both this event and those in the Deep Drive DMAC Fiesta Trophy, doing yeah, the Finnish championship. You've done BRC events. So what does the 2017 look like for you? Do you have any plans already set up? And will we see you in North America again?
Plans are still a little fluid at the moment. I'd really like to see myself in the WRC again next year. We'll have to see where the Junior World Championship goes and Drive DMAC goes next year. But that's sort of where I'm hoping to aim for. The British Championship is without a doubt going from strength to strength. It would be a very exciting place to be next year as well. So those two are good focuses for me. I'm speaking to a number of teams about different options. I would love to be in America next year. I really like it over there. I think the rallying is fantastic. I worked quite hard to get out there in 2014 and into Canada in 2015. So I hope something can be arranged to go to America. We'll have to see what drivers are available and what drivers want to do. But generally, 2017 is looking very, very exciting. And hopefully we can have some good championship with it.
Well, we're certainly very excited to see what's next from you. And I'd love to see you come out this way. Especially, I'd like to see you come out to the West Coast. Here in the States. We got some great stages out here, and it would be fun to see you come along and see what we have to offer.
No, that would be really good. And it would be good to see some American drivers come over this way. Well, maybe not to Australia. I mean, to Europe. They can go to Australia if they want. But they come out to Europe. I know Dylan came out to do Portugal this year, and it'd be really exciting to see some more North American drivers in European events as well.
You know, that's something we'd love to see as well. I think the transition that the American Rally Championships are going through right now is going to probably kind of put that on hold for a little bit, maybe, as I think a new era evolves. I'm sure you've been probably following a little bit some of the changes that have been going on. But I think in the end, it's going to be good. I think there's going to be maybe more opportunities for people. And maybe some growth opportunities as well. We'll have to see how it all pans out. But I would love to see some sort of ladder system like you guys have over there that kind of helps propel young drivers to increase their skill and move on to higher power cars, and then maybe progress from there over to Europe. Yeah, Dylan's a good friend of ours, and he was doing really well. He was sitting fourth for a while there in Portugal.
Really well.
Wrong for him, but yeah, exactly. He definitely showed that, you know, Americans really can do it. You know, they don't just go flying off the road all the time. So, well, again, I'd like to thank Phil Hall for being on the show. Phil, one last little bit. Is there any last thing you'd like to say before we let you go?
Oh yeah, thanks. Yeah, of course. I'd like to thank the sponsors that brought us here for Rally Australia, Demesa Industries and Atlantic Oil, and also the MSA Academy for supporting myself all year. It's been fantastic support from them. And, of course, my father's company for sponsoring me to our enterprises. But, yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show, and I hope to speak to you again very, very soon.
Sounds great. And we all know none of this stuff can ever happen without sponsor support. So thanks very much to them. And we look forward to hopefully seeing you in the States next year. Take care, Phil.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been great to be on, and hopefully I'll be back soon.
All right. Oh. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
I tell you what, it's amazing. Even though I've only been like co-driving for a year, it seems like, you know, there's so much stuff that I can like relate to, you know. He just like talked about doing a stage on signals. I mean, I've done that, you know. It boggles my mind sometimes.
I think it doesn't maybe matter where you're at, you know, and even necessarily even the level that you're at, you know, there's still something you can relate to in this business. You know, I mean, obviously the pace that other people are going at is going to be different and things, but the experience is probably going to be the same, because you being someone that has a little less experience and having to suddenly switch to this mode of having to use hand signals versus someone like, you know, Phil, who has a ton of experience and knowing how to switch into it, he can probably deal with it at that faster pace. The stress level is probably the same because it's really overwhelming you, right?
Yeah.
At a slower pace and him having to deal with that maybe at a faster pace. Yeah, exactly. I think the emotions are the same and maybe the fear as well. that was fabulous. Thanks again to Phil Hall for being on the show, and we wish him much success and really would like to see him next year. Speaking of WRC Australia, let's talk about WRC Australia, shall we? Has everybody watched all of the event or followed it over this last weekend?
I watched it live.
There you go.
Yeah, I watched most of it live, and then I was like watching all the in-car videos as well. So it's like, yeah, we're well set up.
Yeah, I must say that WRC Plus has been my savior. Before, when they had occasionally there was stuff that would show up on a nondescript channel that I'd find on cable that was like 2 months old of WRC coverage. Yeah, WRC Plus is the thing that makes it all possible. And of course, I also listen live to the radio. It was nice to have even though it was a 19-hour difference to hear. It was still during the daytime for me to follow, and that was splendid. Made it a lot easier. So, you know, one of the things we were following this one is because it was VW's last hurrah. This is their final event. It was interesting to see that there actually were team orders of a sorts from Sven Smeets, wasn't there?
Other than ending with a win, yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure I heard Ogier say that if there was the situation arose that he needed to drop back so that Mikkelsen could win the race, win the event, he would. At I'm sure I heard that, but nobody else seems to have heard that. So.
Yeah, I didn't hear that. It seemed like he was just on a mission to win no matter what. It was interesting. I had a little. I posed that question on Twitter, and David Higgins replied back right away saying, "You don't push that hard for 2 days and put yourself in the position that you could possibly win to then back off. You just don't do that." Fair enough. I think he knows probably better than most of us. Well, as Phil told us, the snakes weren't quite as bad, but there was definitely lots of dust and lots of heat down there. But you know, that maybe affected people later on, but really starting on stage one is where we saw issues once again for one Yari Matti Latvala.
Good old Yari Matti, yeah. I think when next year we should probably have a section of the podcast that is the trials and tribulations of Yari Matti Latvala, which we list all his disappointments and everything else. Because he hit that bridge. I mean, what was that, the third corner? He was still on the asphalt. He hadn't even got onto the gravel, had he?
He wasn't more than a kilometer into the first stage.
Mm-hmm. So he was gutted then. But what was really impressed me was the other film we saw of him effecting a repair to the broken suspension with a ratchet strap. I mean, that was ingenuity at its highest level. That was.
That is pretty impressive. It's right up there with fixing a rear control arm with a wrench.
Yes, I think the using a spanner with it was Elfin Evans that I remember doing that. I think I've talked about it before, but he used two hose clamps and a spanner, and put that in between basically to make a solid connection between the two pieces again, and it worked beautifully. Got him definitely through I think another stage or two until he got back to service. So. Yeah, Yari really had to limp that a long ways. That first loop, even though there were shorter stages, it was just painful to see him just slowly kind of slog his way through with that. I mean, ratchet straps only do so much, and that back wheel was wobbling around a bit, wasn't it?
Yeah. He lost like 8 minutes, I think, on the first day due to that. So, but I mean, kudos to him for effecting the repair in the first place. I mean, that was something else to see. I was watching the film and I was thinking, what the devil is he up to? What on earth is he doing? Yeah, I thought maybe he was just like holding it in place so he could like bolt something in place, but no, he really did affect the repair with the ratchet strap. So fantastic.
Make do with what you've got, I guess.
Absolutely. What could he have done if he had duct tape? That's what I want to know.
It'd probably look like one of those things we've seen from Red Green up in Red Green Show, which is a Canadian old program where the guy would build stuff out of duct tape. Anyway, so he wasn't the only one that had issues on the first day. They had a little super special. And Bertelli had an issue as well, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah,
that was funny to watch.
I wish I could have understood Italian, because I was watching the in-car footage, and there was definitely some animated discussion going on inside the car there when they did the spin around, and he headed up the wrong exit. So, but I mean, give the guy his due. I mean, the sunlight was blinding there. I mean, when he was spinning around that pylon, he was actually looking straight into the sun at one point. So I could see how he could easily get lost and confused there. But it did make for some interesting viewing.
And then you know, obviously we get into day two, and Yari Matty says he's back. Where has he been?
I mean, that was, of course, when he won, stage 15 by like 20 seconds. He like smoked everybody else. I mean, it was, yeah, he was on a real high when they interviewed him at the end of the stage. Yeah, I'm back. I've been lost for 6 months. And yeah, he was really, really ebullient there. It was good to see him so happy, you know, because the other times when you see him at the finish line and pretty much every other event that they've covered this year, is like he's been methodical and analytical at the end. Yeah. Oh, we did this and we did that. Oh, we could have done something else better. But this stage 15, that was pure emotion that poured out of him. And that was nice to see.
Yeah, it was good to see emotion that wasn't frustration.
Yeah.
We've seen that all too often. And I don't know what's next for the guy. I think it's Toyota or bus personally, but we'll get into that in a bit. You know, as it played out, obviously sweeping was a factor. Ogier out there in the front, and you could see it on the live stage just how much he was clearing a path. When those roads swept behind him, I mean, it really was like you had a layer of gravel on top of concrete, and once it swept away, it was a hard surface, almost to the point of it was going to get to the point of bluing with the tread there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was almost. Is the surface clay underneath there? What do we know what it is?
It seemed like a form of clay to me. It didn't seem sandy from the looks of it. So. I'd have to say it's got to be some sort of form of clay. And once you got down to that hard surface, though, what was interesting is it didn't necessarily get more grippy. It like went from a layer of where you're sweeping to where actually it got a little bit grippy with the stuff underneath. But then you got like this fine dust that was on top of the hard base layer that they said actually was even slipperier on the second pass than it was on the first pass. So that was definitely interesting. I wasn't quite expecting that. Maybe some of that was due to tire choices. With that kind of heat, most everybody would normally go with a hard tire. And, of course, Ogier went with the softs because he knew he was sweeping anyway, which is going to – usually the soft tire – or, you know, when you're sweeping the road, you're not going to have as much tire wear, right? You're just kind of moving stuff out of the way instead of being able to grip. And so you can get away with that. And Ogier definitely used that to the highest advantage. And he put himself in a strong second place going into the final day. He was just following, I think it was like 2.8 seconds between him and Mickelson going into the final day.
Yeah, it was very tight through a good half of the final day until Ogier's spin.
And that was really the dramatic part of it, wasn't it? You had really kind of three that were able to go for it. It was Mikkelsen who pulled out an early lead. Obviously, Mikkelsen hungry. He wanted to get second in the overall Drivers' Championship. He had to beat out Thierry Neuville, and Thierry ended up a little bit farther back. So he was pushing very hard, and as was Ogier. They went into that final day, and they hit that 30-kilometer stage and on the final day there. And Ogier, of all people, makes a mistake. I mean, how often does that happen?
Well, we're both kind of speechless because it never happens.
Right. I mean, he's so exact all the time. I remember just watching that video of it, and it's like, I couldn't even see how it went. It looked like just the car just stepped out on him without him even realizing it. And next thing you know, he's spinning around.
Well, it wasn't just a spin either. He made contact with a berm.
Ah, okay. So see, it was the onboard that I saw. I didn't see. It was hard to tell that he actually hit something. Well, obviously, it didn't cause much damage because he stayed definitely right up there. But he lost 20 seconds on that stage, was it?
Something like that, 15 or 20.
Yeah, so that pretty well assured Mikkelsen's victory. But also on that stage, you had Padden drop from third to fifth because he got a puncture. And that elevated Thierry Neuville to third place, giving him more points towards that the second in the championship there. I'm sure he was quite happy with that. Padden, very frustrated because it looked like it happened in the first couple of Ks of that long stage. What was actually exciting about that one was when Padden did his second pass through there and was pushing, and he was able to leap ahead of Sordo at the very end and go back to fourth place and lead his much more experienced teammate by 1.6 seconds. So that was definitely cool. So here we had that Wedding Bells, which was the power stage. It was run twice. The first time it was run, that was the live stages that you were watching there, Matt. And Camely didn't make it far into that one, did he?
Oh, no. Well, I'm trying to describe it by what we saw. It was basically video of him taking off, and then a few seconds later, video of the car on its side. He made it, 1.1 kilometers into the stage?
That was all, yeah. Not far at all. So.
Yeah, he just ended up... I'm not even entirely sure what happened. He missed the road a little bit and ended up rolling somehow.
It's difficult to form an opinion when all you've seen is like the in car footage. I mean, it looked like the co-driver was leaning over trying to like force the car around a curve to straighten it up. But we do not know what happened. So I would like to. Amazing that all these WRC cars have all these cameras all over them and. We don't get any footage from the outside of the car when we could really see what had happened. I was a bit disappointed.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's one of those situations where maybe the transponder or the camera just broke during the crash and the video is salvageable at a later date. But still, yeah. I would be curious to see exactly what happened.
Yeah, I think that's the case, is that, you know, they can only have a live stream, you know, from the video feed come off of one of those cameras, right? They can select one, whereas the outside view cameras are just going to a chip, and they scavenge those later. So I'm sure that one got bent up, and they probably have to, you know, had to find it and find the GoPro and, you know, if they had one. And salvage the video off of that. So maybe we'll see that later. But, you know, hasn't that really been kind of the signature of Camely's entire season?
Well, I would think that the signature was what came after. I wanted Yakky Sax playing in the background while they were trying to get that car back on its wheels personally. Because that was
struggle, didn't they? Yeah.
A 15 or 20 minute affair.
Okay. Yeah, it was pretty humorous seeing all of a sudden, you know, more people show up, and then more people show up, they start rocking it back and forth, and it's like, okay, here it's going to go get on its wheels, and wait a minute, they just went onto the roof.
Well, the best part, it wasn't even spectators. It was marshals. They red flagged the stage, they shut it down, and they had a sweep and medical team show up. And they still couldn't figure out how to get the thing back on its wheels.
Now I must say, props to Sweeps. It was awesome to see Sweep highlighted on a stage for the first time in the WRC that I can think of. Hail to the Sweeps!
And it was a badass Hilux.
Yeah,
because
that was a pretty
cool
truck.
Of course it was. We're in Australia.
Right. That truck later to appear in the Dakar Rally. No. so he ended up off the road, and then actually there ended up being a little bit more drama, and the reason why it got delayed so long wasn't so much that they got the car back on its wheels. They tried to move it again. Of course, its suspension completely broken, and one of the wheels turned opposite. And they stopped it, but then a fire started. And right. It looks like what they tried to do is they're putting out the fire, but there's a built-in fire suppression system on the WRC cars. You know, you hit an emergency button on there, and it just floods this, powder stuff right through the underneath the hood. And unfortunately, I think at the time, Camily was actually outside the car and looking at the suspension underneath the front tire just when that plume of all that stuff came out. And that's nasty stuff.
Yeah.
And it seems like he inhaled a little bit of it and was not doing so well. And that's why they called in the medical. The guy's fine. He's okay, thankfully. But wasn't a good thing to have to deal with out there, especially in that 35 degrees Celsius heat. Other bits from this event. Bertelli had more challenges there, Ian.
Yeah, that was really impressed me. On the at the finish of the first round on Wedding Bells, Bertelli said, "Oh wow." Was it our rear diff and front dampers are shot, and the TV commentators were saying, oh, well, that's their rally done for the day. But no, they went back to service and they changed the rear diff and front dampers in 30 minutes. I mean, there was a live stream on Facebook and on WRC. You could watch the guys doing the work. I mean, I was amazed. I mean, it's like ever since like Audi changed an entire rear end at like Le Mans a few years ago in like 45 minutes, it's been expected from worked teams that you can like pull off mechanical miracles like this. But Bertelli, essentially, that he's a privateer, even though there were a few guys with M Sport overalls
right.
on going around the car. But to like remove a rear diff and do some front dampers in 30 minutes, I mean, You go round to your local service station and say, can you do that for me? They'll laugh at you.
Yeah, we're going to need it all day, sir.
come back next week. Yeah, but it always amazes me what they can do in the time they're given. The length of the complexity of repair that they can do in the time they've got. It just, I'm always amazed, and always, you've got to give credit to those guys. Those guys who are able to buckle down and work at that pressure and that speed to do something in 30 minutes. It's amazing.
Indeed. The mechanics and support people in Rally rarely get highlighted and shown what they can really do. Being able to assess the problem, being able to, get the parts, take out the old one, put in the new one, replace the fluids. I mean, do all that stuff. Just amazing work.
Yeah, and they seem to be like so relaxed about it, even though it's like a stressful, busy situation. They seem everybody knows what they're doing, and there's a calm, relaxed atmosphere to it. And yeah, even to the extent that some of the mechanics were coming up and mugging in front of the camera. All the repair was going on.
I saw
that a couple of times. Yeah, it made me laugh. So, yeah, so huge props to Bertelli's pit crew. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that's definitely a good crew, and I hope to see him back out there next year.
Absolutely,
for sure.
Yeah.
I want to also give mad props to the TV crew for the best power stage shots I've ever seen. The combination of helicopter shots and different parts of the stages that they covered with panning cameras and stuff was probably the best power stage coverage I've seen all season. You could really feel, you could sense the speed. That's one thing that's often not covered very well is the speed these cars are really going at. And I remember seeing just one of them going along one of the straights there with the plume of dust behind him. And I'm just like, you could, even though it's being followed by a helicopter, which, you know, helicopters are not slow, you could just see the car just blistering its way down that stage. And it was some of the best coverage I've ever seen.
Well, I liked how they let us sit in moments like that tracking shot, just following a car down a fast sweeping section of the power stage. We sat on that shot for a minute and a half, just following. I love that. I mean, far too often you see video coverage in racing spliced together almost like an action movie where you do jump cut, jump cut, jump cut, and you don't actually get a sense of exactly what's going on. And they did, the WRC crew did a very good job of making me feel like I was there this weekend, especially during that power stage. So definitely props to him.
Yeah, I still have my opinions on Desborough's commentary. But aside from that...
I'm talking about the video crew,
but the video part was impressive for sure. So it all boiled down to Mickelson being able to hold it out for his third victory now. So he won in Poland ahead of Tanak. And now he wins here in Australia, holding off. And hats off to him to a straight-up one-on-one battle against the four times world champion. He was able to beat him fair and square. There was no advantage, right? They're one right after the other on the stages. And Ogier made the mistake. He was pressured into it. And that was a brilliant drive from Mickelson. He still didn't quite make, though, his second in the championship. Because Neuville got to move up to third, that it definitely helped him. Plus, he got two more points, I think, in the power stage. And that elevated him above Mickelson for the championship, for a second in the championship. But Mickelson, boy, that sure does up the ante for where he might be next year, don't you think?
Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, it's certainly not done him any damage, has it? He's certainly impressed. So it's like, it muddies the waters a bit because last time we talked, we couldn't think where to put Mickelson, could we? You know, you said, and where's Mickelson going? And we all went, I don't know. I still don't know. It all depends on Ogier, but he certainly didn't do himself any harm there with that performance.
No, definitely not. He's definitely elevated his stock at this point. It's a very strong finish, and it does absolutely nothing but help him.
Well, and again, beating the four times world champion, that obviously does wonders for potential a career boost. Honestly, right now, if it was me, if I have the choice between, if I'm Toyota and that's a difference between Latvala and Mickelson, I'd take Mickelson instantly, without a doubt.
Definitely.
Yeah.
He's able to handle the pressure and be able to push when he needed to and back off when he needed to. You know, Ogier ended up finishing within 10 seconds of him because, well, once he knew he had that 20 seconds in reserve, he's like, I don't need to push anymore. You know, I'll do this at a brisk pace, but not, you know, not overly push. And he still won the event. And just a brilliant, brilliant drive, very calculated. Speaking of those that like to push all the time, WRC2, we have the new champion because he won by a decisive, oh my goodness, 4.5 minutes ahead of the next place. Esa-Pekka Lappi just dominated in Australia.
When do we transition from using the word dominate to ridiculous? Because,
yeah,
come on. How? I don't even know how that happened. It just kind of showed up at the end of, what, day two when he pulled out that lead?
He was just so much faster than anybody else, even when the cars were working fine. You know, they're all talking about, you know, oh, it's slippery out there. And he's like, yep, slippery, and I still beat you by 30 seconds on this stage. you know, what can you say? The man seemingly has no fear. he's able to just wring everything out of that Skoda and get really fast stage times. I'm so excited to see him in the top level next year. Rumor has it that I saw on Twitter was a post that there's somebody that was posting some article that was Finnish that supposedly confirmed that Lappi has signed with Toyota already for 2017. I hope to see that because this young man is a future champion, I think, for sure.
I won't disagree with you there on that one. He was really impressive. Yeah, it'll be good to see him in a step up to the next league and see how quickly he copes.
Well, it's the typical formula for a new team starting up, right? You have the seasoned professional, whoever that becomes, to sort of lead the development and the team, so to speak, like be the general leader. And then you have your young gun who's there just to show up and be fantastic. And every once in a while capture a headline saying like, oh, Toyota's doing amazing because of Lappi. Like, right?
mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely could be that. We'll have to see what their decisions are. I'm guessing we'll hear that in the coming weeks. so much to hurry up and wait for, I guess, because we just don't know what's going to happen with those big teams just yet. One thing they did do in Australia after the event is, of course, this is when you have the big DRC gala where they do the awards for the whole season. That's something that Australia, one reason why they wanted to have the championship down there is because it's a resort place, mm-hmm. right? You've got, it's summer down there, and this time of year would make a great place for what teams show up anyway. That's the thing that I think bothers me the most, is it's so far away. To have it as the last event of the year, if you're totally out of the championship, you know, why go? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you're a manufacturer team, you have to go. You're required to go to every event. But, you know, you get some of these support teams that, you know, the privateers, why pay the money to ship a car over there and your team over there? It's just a lot of money for the fact that you're not going to really be getting anything. But for all those top guys out there, there was the big gala award ceremony, and it looked like it was fabulous. Everybody was dressed to the nines, and they handed out a few awards. And amazingly enough, Driver of the Year did not go to Sebastian Ogier, did it?
Yeah, that's a surprise, isn't it? I mean, guy wins four world titles in a row, and he's not Driver of the Year. I suppose he didn't dominate the season, though, did he? There's like six events where he didn't win. So there's reason to not give him that award. But did he win it last year? Did he win the Driver of the Year last year?
He did.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, he won it last year. That's fine. Give it to somebody else who deserved it. So yeah, I have no problem with Tanak winning that award. He's acquitted himself well this year. I mean, he's coming so close in Poland, was it?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think he's going to be on the top step of the podium next year.
He's doing the best with the tires he's got.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was interesting about the tires stuff. You know, he dropped some time on the longest stage, and I frustrated him like, oh man, you know, if it wasn't for those darn tires. And I actually got a reply back from DMAC on Twitter saying that it wasn't the tires because apparently and he's right in that. I remember Colin was at the end of that longest stage and the tires actually were in good shape. They were not completely destroyed. But sometimes it's just where if the tires are too stiff, or you know, you still can't get grip, or something like that. I don't know what the situation was, but I still think that the D-Max aren't quite up to the task. Obviously, we had where they performed better in certain situations, such as the wet in Rally GB, but they were not quite on the pace for this event, because I think Hoyt was doing just fine out there, but I think he was hampered by something. I don't know what it was, but so far the consistency seems to be the tires aren't quite there. So sorry, D-Mac, I don't want to just blame you guys, but it seems like the common thread over the season. They're a great sponsor, though. Love D-Mac tires. They do a lot of sponsorship here in the States as well, and their tires seem to work pretty well here. Maybe it's because our conditions are a little bit different. But we also had co-driver of the year, and that also did not go to a VW driver, did it? Or a co-driver?
No, it went to a Hyundai co-driver, specifically Nicolas Gilsoul, Thierry Neuville's co-driver. Well, what are your thoughts on that, guys?
Ian? No? no opinion?
I mean, but just because I'm a co-driver, come to me for my opinion.
Hell yeah!
Well, it just makes sense, doesn't it?
That's why you were hired, guess, come on!
I don't know. I'm not, to be honest, I haven't followed the co-driving that much. I mean, it's like I have been watching the co-drivers a lot, but I've been doing it from the studious angle. I've been watching them to learn how they are doing, how the cadence on the calling and how they're pacing themselves and such like that. I don't really have any opinion on how any one co-driver is any better than another.
Yeah, they all seem to be, you know, such professionals at that level that it's hard to really compare, to be honest. You know, there are times they make errors, though. Case in point, one reason why Danny Sordo was farther back is they arrived at time control 2 minutes late and got a 20-second penalty. So it can happen. So, I can see where that would maybe take you off the list.
And I would think that Tanak's co-driver should go up the list because their intercom quit during a stage.
That's right.
In Wales, and he had to switch on the fly in the middle of the stage to doing hand signals. So, you know, why didn't he get it as well?
sure. Okay, but you know,
so they could have been co-drivers of the year.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, we're getting punny now. Well, I will say that, you know, it is a team effort between the driver and the co-driver. The co-driver also kind of helps set the pace for the driver, kind of pushes them maybe a little bit, or can maybe woe them up a little bit based on how they give the notes. And considering Thierry's improvement last year to this year, and looking that he's got second in the championship this year now, I can see why that Nicolas Gilsoul got that as the award, and I think it's definitely fitting. Although, again, the other co-drivers also do an amazing job, but I think the level of improvement from what they were at before is probably a factor here. One of my favorites of the awards was the Certina Timing Award, and that went to Hayden Baden for his run over El Condor in Argentina. And did you guys ever watch the comparison between that, him versus Sebastien Ogier on that stage?
I watched Hayden Baden on El Condor a lot, but I watched the forward facing camera because it was just, on the upper reaches of that hill, it was just like stunning to watch. I mean, you're going down a kart track and there's ruts and bumps all over, and you're going over a bridge where it seems like the bridge pillars like are only like 6 inches wider than the car is. And yeah,
about that,
it was just stunning to watch. I mean, it's like, I watched that time and time again, just because I couldn't believe that you could drive down there like that. It was stunning.
Yeah, I think that was definitely a fitting, you know, award for that kind of the best stage kind of award, I guess what you call this one, because I remember Hayden talking about this, that specific stage was one that he had focused a lot of energy on. It's been run many times. We all know El Condor. It's been one of the staples of the WRC, and coming down to that final power stage in the end, where him and Ogier were close. And he pulled out, was it, did he finish like 20 seconds quicker? 15 or 20 seconds quicker than Ogier on that stage?
Yeah, it was a big gap, certainly.
It was massive. And going into it, there was nothing between them. There was like 5 seconds, like 3 or 5 seconds. It wasn't
Just
hardly anything.
Wasn't Ogier the fastest first time down El Condor?
He was because because Patton on the first run through that, because that ended up being the power stage as well, right? So on the first run through it, Patton actually had a half spin. The car
Yeah, that was
stalled.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, and so he lost time, and that's how he ended up getting Ogier ended up closer because Patton actually had a bigger lead at the time. So then they ended up within, like I said, a few seconds of each other when it came around to that second run through it. So, man, what a way to pull that off and just stretch out such a lead at the end. Brilliant job, and I have no arguments with that one being the award given there. Finishing up the awards here, we got WRC 6 Livery of the Year. So that's, I guess, like the game. But they gave to Lorenzo Bertelli's mirror finish on his car. I'm not a huge fan of mirror finishes. I don't know your guys' opinion.
Well, yeah.
Gives me a
Well,
Russian vibe. Or Justin Bieber. Not sure which one's worse.
all right. I'll beg to differ. I'll be happy with it. I liked it. It was different. You know, it's like the guy doesn't have any sponsors, so he's to speak of. So he's got to stand out in another way. So and reflective finish. I mean, I liked it. I thought it was really good. And of course, you've got the name on the back as well, which we can't really say just in case we have some family viewing going on, family listening going on.
Fudge matey. There we go. We'll let you translate. There we go. Yeah, true, true. Yeah,
Because all the
I
other
can.
liveries, they're just like advertising hoardings. At least he's with
Sure.
no sponsors to kowtow to. Is that I really I did the reflective livery really did stand out. Yeah.
That's
It
fair.
did.
It is pretty unique in terms of a motorsport setting.
I will say this, I bet his car was a few degrees cooler in those hot temperatures than everybody else.
Certainly should be, shouldn't it?
It's not my favorite livery, but hey, people, that was people voting on that one.
Yeah.
There was also an award for the Aerial Award, DJI Aerial Award, and looks like that was given to the biggest jump, right, Matt?
It was given to Mikkelsen for the big spectator jump at Portugal. I don't know. I don't know how you could pick one car from that jump because they all kind of did it exactly the same way. Personally, I would have given that to the R5 car that set the record at Collins Crest.
Oh yes, Evan Brynjolfsson. Yep. Yeah, that was a
Is
brilliant
that
jump.
how you pronounce that?
Yes, Evan Brynjolfsson.
That is a much simpler pronunciation than the spelling would suggest.
I only know because I listen to WRC Live Radio, and so thanks to Bex and Colin for doing pronunciations for me, and I just listen.
Well, the thing is, Brittleson's jump, he went flat out over there, just balls to the wall. Just went for it. To me, that's far more spectacular than just kind of like the everyday routine jump that everybody else was doing at Pfaffe.
Ian, your thoughts?
I think a lot to do with it is with Pfaff is it's the location. You know, it looks a plain ordinary location, but you've got all the wind turbines in the background, and then there was the helicopter coming over the
Oh,
top of the
it's.
jump as well. I mean, it was a stunning sight to see. I mean, it's like we were sharing photographs from Faf in our off-air chat the other day, weren't we? And it's I think the photographs from Faf this year are like some iconic some of the iconic photographs in the history of WRC. So,
especially with the helicopters falling right behind, yeah. You got the car in the air, and they've got that banner right there, right?
Yep.
And then you got this helicopter crawling up over that crest right behind it. And
that's true. It looks like the helicopter's jumping too because they're doing that big pitch.
Yeah. So they have also what they called the Michelin Magic Moment Award. Fittingly, went to Wojciech Tanak for his performance in Poland. I definitely give that.
Well, I don't know. It's like rubbing it in that you didn't win, isn't it?
Yeah. I think his just overall pace, though, I mean, what really killed on that one was what he ended up getting a puncture on the penultimate stage. And it started just pouring down rain. And on the penultimate stage, he halfway through it, he got a puncture and dropped like 15 seconds, and that's how he lost it. So, it looked like it was just his to win. And it was just one of those unfortunate things that just happened. But to me, Poland was definitely a breakout moment, I think, for Wojciech, because not only was he fast, he was comfortably fast. Mm. You know what I mean? He was going that quick. It was similar to Chris Meek when he did Unimpoja this year in Finland.
Yeah.
He comes to the end of that stage like, yeah, that felt good. You just did the record fastest stage ever. Oh, really? It just felt good. You know? I mean, when you've got that kind of a pace and you can just stay calm and collected, that's really just getting into the zone there. And the fact that Wojciech's kind of reached that level now, he used to push too much and make mistakes. And I think he's beyond that now, and it's great to see. So let's wrap it up here with these trophies. They gave special trophies to Sven Smeets, the VW team did, for its fourth clean sweep of driver, co-driver, and manufacturer titles. Fitting. As we say goodbye to them. One of the other cool ones that came out was the Lexar Photograph of the Year shots. And that was a brilliant shot. It is of Hayden Padden coming down that El Condor Pass with a helicopter behind it that looks like it's actually in the wash of the dust coming from behind that car at Solo.
Gorgeous photo.
Yeah, we'll post that.
It seems like to have a good rally photograph these days, you've got to have a helicopter in the background.
That's why we love Oregon Trail in the States here.
Yes, we definitely do like getting those helo shots. That's some great. You know, the downside to the open stages is they're not as interesting with the twists and turns. But the awesomeness is you get such great views of both the mountain ranges in the background and the cars going flat out, and of course those gorgeous helicopter shots.
Well, it also helps that the WRC helicopter pilot is an absolute madman in the best possible way.
Agreed.
Just a ridiculously talented pilot.
Yeah, so last bit they had, I guess, best news story of the year. It's all in French. I couldn't read it, but it looks like it had something to do with Craig Breen, who also had a fabulous, partial season. The kid's got talent, and it'll be exciting to see him next year. Good stuff there. So, yeah, that was it. VW is gone, guys. That was the end. So, time to hurry up and wait until 2017 and the new cars, eh?
Yep,
that's one way to put it.
There's going to be plenty of rumors going around in the next week as Ogier tests all the. Isn't he going to test Ford, the Toyota, and
Citroen?
Citroen, yeah. Isn't he supposed to be testing all three cars in the next 10 days or so?
The rumor that I've heard is it's definitely, it'll at least be M Sport and the Fords and Toyota. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure about Citroën.
It all depends which which rumors you listen to, doesn't it?
Yep,
I heard it was going to be Citroen and Toyota this week, and okay. he would be testing the Ford next week. But
that way he can bring at least some information over to Malcolm. Perfect.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But maybe there's something.
Planned it that way.
Yeah, maybe there's something to be read into that. So I'll go to Ford last and take what I've learned with me. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll start the rumor now. Yeah.
I guess the photographs from the testing will be making their way onto the internet pretty soon. We'll have that to follow and get excited about. So.
Indeed. And of course, before we get into the 2017 season for that, though, we're going to have Dakar coming, and we'll have to do our own little Dakar special to preview that, because we all love following the Dakar rally, which already has a bunch of exciting rumors of what's going to be going on there, some changes, some new cars, things like that. So, mm-hmm. Well, let's switch our attention now then. Now WRC is officially done and dusted. Sad to see it go, but... I do appreciate that their championship runs as long as it does. IndyCar. let's talk about North American Rally, and we had big announcements this week. Rally America has released their 2017 schedule, but it's in a very different format than what we've seen before.
Yeah, it is not at all what we expected. For one, it is... How many rounds? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.5?
Well, 7.5 rounds, but they call it 14 rounds.
Yeah. there's two half rounds, isn't there? There's,
yep. So
the events go on a Friday and a Saturday, and that's for 1, 2, 3, 4. That's for 5 rounds, isn't it? And then there's two rounds that are like Saturdays only, and they're... They only score like half points for the title.
Right. And they did do what you and I expected them to do, Mike, at one point. Summer Snowdrift is one of those rounds.
As is the Show Me Rally. Right. So, which is 100 Acre Wood stages. So what they've done here is, and we kind of called this out a little bit, kind of in our prediction, is... they've kind of been relegated to being a regional championship now. They just don't have the support of Subaru and all the contingency dollars and all that stuff. But with the position they're in, they've done something that a lot of the regionals really get excited about. Although the funny thing is, it doesn't really make that much of a difference. In the normal national championship rallies that we had in 2016 and years past, each regional... was actually each day of the event, right? So, no different. You look at Snowdrift, and what they call round one now is called the Snow Rally, which is day one, and the round two, the second day, is called the Drift Rally. Snow, Drift, get it? Right. Before, what would happen is, you'd enter in as national, and if you had a problem, or you crashed out, you'd have to go into Super Rally, right? And get penalties, and then you could start again the next day or whatever. Now they're like, well, we're getting rid of Super Rally. And everybody's like, oh, yeah. We're so sick of Super Rally. It is the worst thing ever with Rally. There's a lot of opinions about Super Rally out there. So what it is each day is its own set of points. So if you, if you finish, the first on round one, day one, you're going to get a certain amount of points for that. I don't know the exact point structure of how many points for each one of these quote-unquote rounds. If you finish third the next day, you don't end up finishing third overall in general. It's the combination of the first you got the first day and the third you got the next day, which kind of puts you probably around second, right? So it's a very different way of doing it. If I was going to compare it to something... it would be similar to how some of the regional championships like we have with our Cascadia Cup, our Cascadia International Rally Championship that we have out here in the West. It's its own scoring system that combines the regional stuff from what was Rally America events, NASA events, and up in Canada with Canadian events. They had to come up with their own scoring system that would work across all these different forms of championships, and this seems to work really well. They also do this kind of thing down in Australia, where they have each day is a different score. So I think it works, but to me, again, this means it's more of a regional championship, not a national championship.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
It certainly feels that way. It does, yeah, because typically with the regional events, those are run individual days in conjunction with the national event, right? So your national event, let's take the 100 Acre Wood, for instance. In years past, 100 Acre Wood, both days was a national event, and the regionals ran Trespassers Will, which was the first day stages on Friday, mm-hmm. and then they ran, what was the name of it? I can't remember. They're calling it the 100 Acre Wood Rally now. It had a different name.
You're right, it did.
Those were scored individually as regional days. So mm-hmm. it seems that now they're adopting that format for their national series. And you're right. It just kind of screams we're catering to regionals now.
It, you know, and I can't say that's a bad thing in that, you know, I'd have to say, you know, 70% of all entries at any event is going to be regional. You know, here at Oregon Trail, you know, we get a ton of regional entries, and really they're the ones that pay most of the bills with their entries. We get a couple of national guys. Obviously, sponsorship helps a ton for us to put on an event. But as far as entry fees go, it is more regionals than anybody else that enters. So catering to the regionals to try and draw them in is, I think, a smart move on their part. They now know where they kind of sit, and by catering to their needs, I guess maybe that's going to work. But one thing I wanted to kind of discuss here is not only do we have these 14 kind of sub-rounds that they're doing, it's the fact that they have some brand new rallies on this list, some I've never heard of.
Well, yeah, I was going to say we're catering to regionals now, so it kind of makes sense that they're also trying to expand into regions that don't typically have rallies, but may have sort of a rally following in them, right? So the first of those new events is the Southern Ohio Forest Rally. This is one that I've kind of heard of in passing. I think it was a failed event from a number of years ago.
Yeah, back in the SCCA Pro Rally days, I believe, there was rallies in Southern Ohio, yeah.
Right, we're going back 20, 25 years here.
Yeah.
So we're expanding into the Midwest, Ohio, which doesn't have a rally now that I can think of. And we're doing a full two-day event. Apparently in, where are they saying it is? It's somewhere south of Columbus.
Chillicothe, or however you pronounce it, I believe that's what I've heard, because I've been told to I've been asked if I can leave that weekend free just in case I'm needed for co-driving duties.
Oh well, there you go. I've heard that the roads in that area are absolutely gorgeous. Southern Ohio, especially that area of Southern Ohio, because it's a little eastern, shares a big forest region with West Virginia. So it's just woods everywhere. It's a really pretty area. But apparently the roads are very nice as well, from what I've been hearing from people who live in the area and old SCCA guys from way back when. So hopefully that event goes off well.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, obviously, one thing that we always hear, the more rally, the better. That's an area that maybe has been starved for rally. Maybe they've been hoping to organize one for some time, and we're just not in the know. And they've been kind of working towards this for a while, and now's just the trigger point to try and make this happen. The only concerning thing whenever you have a new round is, number one, it's getting the volunteers out there to help. You can't run an event without having a shit ton of volunteers. You literally need double the volunteers than you think you really need, because only half of them will show up. Because that's just what happens. And yeah, that's probably one of the challenges I'm going to have, training new people that have never done this before. Granted, we always end up with new people at every event, but usually have a seasoned person that can be there with them. And this is mostly all new. I mean, you got to start somewhere for sure.
I would expect them to try and invigorate the LSPR base in Michigan, because quite frankly, it's a drive, but it's not a completely unreasonable drive for people that are really into it.
Yeah, and there does seem to be a lot of interest, a lot of enthusiasm for that rally right now. If you go out there on Facebook and look at the Southern Ohio Forest Rally Facebook page, there's a lot of excited interest there. So I mean, things do look good for that one at the minute. So
yeah, it does look good. It does. I saw some responses on Facebook when we posted it on our Facebook page, and the organizers there are definitely keen on getting this one going. They just finally posted a Facebook page. That was one of the concerning things when it first was released. There wasn't a coordination with a web page and a Facebook page, stuff that the event even really existed. So they got to get that stuff in order. Kind of a little bit, I guess on my part, I'd say, you know, as a media guy, that's kind of poor planning. You want to make sure that if you're going to have this new event, they're ready to launch when you are, when you have to release a schedule. But that said, I do hope it happens. The other event we've talked about before, Rally Colorado, that's the one that clashes with New England Forest Rally. But, you know, the Western people, half the distance, they're probably not going to be taking, you know, trailering all the way to New England unless they're doing the national championship with ARA. So the Western regional guys might go as far as Colorado for that one. Sounds like some exciting stages there. As we said last time, city stage in Denver. I mean, I'm really excited to see what happens there. The Gardner family is running that one. We all know Tracy Gardner. That's exciting. We talked about Summer Snowdrift. And then we got this new Rally Wyoming. Now, that one seems a little more remote and concerning to me than Southern Ohio.
This one seems a little far-fetched.
This one is real mystery. Honest. Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out where the base is there.
Yeah, because I was once I'd checked out Facebook for the Southern Ohio Forest Rally page, I thought, well, we'll see if there's anything for Rally Wyoming. And there was nothing out there. There doesn't even really appear to be any kind of like rally cross even based interest in the state. I mean, there was a couple of rally cross Facebook pages, but the last entry on one of the pages was like 2 years ago. So I was like, you know, Wyoming needs to get out there and start publicizing and get things going, drum up some enthusiasm in that area.
You know, being where you are, Ian, how far would it be to get into Wyoming to do some, let's say it was even on the easternmost part of Wyoming, for the Midwest guys, how long would it take them to get there?
Would be about a 13-hour drive for me, 13 and a half hour drive. Compare that to like Southern Ohio, which would be like a 12-hour drive. So there's not a lot to choose between. Well, 90 minutes is 90 minutes, but it's still a long drive. It's still a full day's drive.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess that's not too obscene. You know, I mean, I guess anytime you're over 8 hours, that's pretty tough. But, if they're willing to, I mean, I'm guessing that's what their focus is. It seems like the majority of these events, of course, are in the Midwest, and that's going to be their focus. There's plenty of rallies in that area. I can imagine that some place like Wyoming has plenty of open roads that they'd love to have just people come out there and visit, because Wyoming has such a low population. Sure, we don't care, right? Then we've got the Show Me Rally, and then we've got LSPR, as we had already known was going to remain on the list. That's a two-day for that one. Like I said, it sounds exciting that there's going to be potentially more events. The Wyoming one is the one I think it's probably the biggest concern as far as whether it will really happen. I hope it does, because, like I said, the more rally, the merrier. So a little bit of a different change in their championship. There was a post actually on the Rally America web on their Facebook page trying to explain the new scoring system. I want to just kind of read it out real quick. Maybe it'll help clarify it a little bit. It says, there is still one overall two-day national event, just as there was in the past. For example, the Snowdrift Rally would be a combination of Friday and Saturday, as we said, with regional rally on Friday and Saturday. The only thing that has changed is the point scoring system. Super Rally has been replaced with scoring points on each day. With the new system, if you DNF on either day, you'll be scored as a DNF in the national event. However, if you finish one of these days, you will still earn some points toward the national championship. The goal of the new system is to fix the problem associated with Super Rally. Now, once you DNF, you cannot get back on the podium. So, I guess the idea is, I'm trying to figure out how their podium works on that second day. If, let's say, you DNF the first day.
I'm going to guess from that wording that the podium is exclusively for people that have run finished both days.
Yeah, it's got to be.
It seems like they're kind of doing half points for a national championship for each day.
Yeah, probably.
So let's say first place is worth 10 points. If you finish first on the first day, you'll get 5. If you finish first on the second day, you'll get 5. Those are made up numbers, but I'm pretty sure that's the way they're doing this. They're trying to give a consolation prize like you have with hockey or soccer if you make it into overtime and you don't, or in football when you draw.
Right, right.
Just give you something for showing up and playing that well, in a sense.
Well, definitely interesting to see what's going to happen with it. I sent out a request to maybe get Bill Fogg on the show and talk about his new championship. Haven't heard back from him yet, but it would be good to have him on the show since we've talked to Tim O'Neill of ARA. So it would be nice to get a different take on the other championship. Now that we have two national championships. I must say I do like this format over the shootout concept that you have in NASA. I mean, that's just a different way of doing it. That's just kind of their thing because they do kind of have the two separate regions, like East and West, and then they kind of combine together. But this still has a little bit more of a national championship feel to it. But again, it's done more with in a regional style, right? So, yeah, interesting stuff. We don't really have anything else going on. We've got, Canadian Rally Championship has their Tall Pines coming up this coming weekend. Travis Pastrana is going to be going up there and getting some seat time, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with him versus Antoine Lestage.
Exciting.
We'll have to see how that goes. Yeah, that'll be exciting. I know he's wanting to get a little bit more seat time and experience before the 2017 championship.
Do we know if that's a full SRT thing?
It's an SRT car for sure.
Okay.
Exciting to see that. Ian, did you have any last words before we let everybody go for the evening?
No, I don't. It's been fun again. I've learned something about being a co-driver from our guest from England, from the old country. So it's been a good evening.
All right. Well, you take care and make sure you drive careful in the snowy conditions out there. Matt, any parting shots?
How about happy Thanksgiving?
Oh, yes, we do have a holiday this week, so hopefully we'll get this posted before Thanksgiving happens. Have a very happy Thanksgiving. And for Ian Holmes and Matt Kalish, I'm Mike Shaw, and again, thanks to Phil Hall for being on the show. This is Open Paddock. Have a good night.